There are a lot of tired old positions running out of road in today's podcast. One is the British government's continuing tolerance of the war crimes that are happening in Israel at the same time that the Foreign Affairs Committee chief, Alicia Cairns, has admitted that legal advice says that Israel is now committing international crimes in Gaza. None more so and more shocking than the apology for the death of seven aid workers because they were innocent citizens by Netanyahu, when those tens of thousands of Palestinians dying seems to have meant nothing. We discuss all of that. We talk about, obviously, Hamza and the hate crime bill, Hamza and his first year in office, worries about the lack of vigour in the Scottish Government's programme, worries about the fact that Thames Water will soon go bust and Scottish taxpayers will end up helping to fork out to solve the problem of English privatised water.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Johnson. Welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And, you know, we've been doing swappies, Leslie and I, in terms of it was too thick for me last week. Update, that's not going to be a root canal. That's going to be an extraction. Yippee!
Oh, that is better.
Yes, it is, actually. It's considerably better. So, yeah, we had a little look at that and we had a discussion and it went, nah, it's coming out in a couple of weeks' time. So there we go. That's what that there. But you have had the dreaded Lurgy, which has been floating around the country.
It was one of these ones where the symptoms are so bad and they just come through like a hurricane. You know, so actually I did a Q&A after a really excellent screening of the film at the Cameo. I mean, astonishing, 250 folk in there, lovely audience. Joanna Cherry was kind of chairing it, and I began to have a bit of a sore head as it was going on. By the time I came home, I was shaking. I mean, not just sort of like shivering, you know, it felt like cartoon shaking, you know, just couldn't get temperature under control. Felt like someone had taken a hammer and banged it all over my left hand. And then just went through, you know, a series of things like that. Every kind of few hours, it would turn into something else. But basically, you can't keep your temperature under control. You're either absolutely boiling hot or you're absolutely freezing. Muscle pain, joint pain. Actually, intrusive thoughts. I spent one entire night thinking that somebody was trying to bomb every airfield in Fife.
Okay.
I don't know if I think there are many airfields in Fife, but yeah, in this dream where only I knew that they were doing it, and there was something to do with the sort of, you know, the size of the airfield. It was just all these irritating. Your mind's just going, I don't care what size the airfield is, but in your head you're constantly going, but what size is it? And you're going, I don't care. You know, so like. Jeez. So three days of all this nonsense anyway, and then totally wabbit. So kind of like you kind of just fall asleep for 2 hours in a chair and then you get up and think, I'll just go and make a cup of tea. Mind you, that sofa, and then you're out for another 3 hours.
Yeah.
But the turning point, I think, was that one beautiful day of summer. spring, let's just settle for that. Beautiful. Yeah. And I went round to the wee pond that I dug in last year, maybe the year before, and I keep trying to plant things in the pond to make it kind of real, like to have made it worth the effort. And each year I've had to go and find some wee bits of frog spawn and transplant it in. And you see the wee tadpoles for a while and then you don't see them and then you think, I don't know, nature works for everything else, but not here. Yeah. Dancer. I went round the corner to just, you know, get rid of some cuttings and stuff. There is a massive clump of, I did not put it there, frog spawn. And from that minute on, I thought, game back on, you know. And then you feel yourself coming back into yourself. It's like spring inside yourself, because you assume, especially at our age, you know, you don't expect renewal. You don't expect recovery, actually, you know. And then to feel yourself rising again, all your powers beginning to come back into you, it's like, wow. So now I am, I've been off at Pilates this morning. I was out in the garden and I'm having to control myself from just, yes, you know, I can I'm going to live. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, so
I did actually make sure that the girls knew where my will was. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Been through that one.
So,
oh, God,
yes.
Yeah, Jill said that to me once. She says, what they're doing, I'm just telling everybody where our wills are. And that's where they're starting, you know, it's all done there. But no, what you say is absolutely 100% correct, because any time I've been feeling ill, I just feel so bad. And then suddenly you realise I'm normal again, and it feels enervated. But funnily enough, we actually popped out. We were out at and other recreational facilities are available, folks. We were at the Scottish Deer Centre on Sunday with the grandkids and great nieces and everything like that. It was absolutely fabulous. And it was a great day out. But one of the things that I did, and it's we'll be taking walks around and about, getting to know the new area that we moved into, which is slightly more in the countryside than we've done before, and discovering new walks. And it's these unexpected clumps of daffodils that we've been coming across. I don't know if you found this. You're on a wee walk and there's a bit of waste ground, and then look, there's daffodils. And it's a real cheery up, and as I say, in the most unexpected places.
Although, if you're going to do, you know, just to be the miserablest in this, I'm sure this isn't true, but I always think that that's the sign of that there's been somebody before. You know, there's been a house where there's been something. I mean, I noticed that near me here, and you see actual, you know, bushes that are not just random natural bushes, you know, that are quite specific ones, clumps that are, you know, the arrangement's quite not quite, you know, random. And then you realise there was a kind of salmon bothy here for 100 years, and it's kind of underneath it all. Or, I mean, you know, I'm sure every clump of daffodils cannot be explained by a ruined house, you know. But that's what it makes me think of, you know, things past and things not present.
Well, the other thing I noticed, things pass and things no longer there, are the setting up of the, we've seen in the village, these wee three libraries in old telephone boxes. And it's been fantastic. And just, again, just easily cheered up. I mean, and yeah, and to quote the Saw Doctors, though, will it ever stop raining? Like, I noticed that people who actually follow the podcast may or may not notice that I slip in song titles into quite a few of the titles for the podcast. But you actually are channeling your inner Alice Cooper with your latest article about Humza Yousaf, No More Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah, ba-ding. There you go.
I'm ashamed to say I wasn't actually. I was waiting for a sort of schools out or elected kind of, you know, theme. But
no. No more Mr. Nice Guy, no more Mr. Mean.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yes, well, that's the headline. And, okay, there was one. I do often sort of look and think, where did they get that from? And
then did I write that article?
Yes, she did write that one sentence. And you think, right, yeah. I mean, sometimes you think, and I mean, I'm sure none of the national people have got the time to be listening to this, but you do sometimes wonder if they sort of look at it and think, oh, God, another 1,400 words of waffling, kind of, you know, virtual beard pulling. Have we got some normal little phrase in this that we could use? You know what I mean? But anyway, I did indeed, you know, so I was just looking at Humza's first year as first minister. And I mean, pretty much, in fact, I was quoting somebody else who had made a comment on The National and described him as the archetypal nice guy, someone with a CV more suited to head up a third sector international charity than lead a nation to freedom, you know, which is a bit. And when you see, you know, the kind of verdicts there's been on him, it's generally 6 or 7 out of 10, which, you know, I was just kind of asking, is that, you know, is that good enough? Is it fair? What do people think? And this is such a big, big, big question, because obviously in it sits everything to do with, well, just everything, actually. And what I ended up sort of concluding, I mean, everybody will know the long list of things that have happened over the year. Although I do think the absence of strikes in Scotland is something that has got really kind of stuck way down the kind of, you know, kind of list of priorities. And it's quite something. I mean, just as a small thing, I'm going down to do Trevor Phillips' Sky programme on Sunday in London. And I tried to book the train on Friday, or was it Friday? No, it was Saturday going down. And, you know, even maybe 2 weeks ago when I booked, there were no seats left. Now, right. I mean, I do confess this in the spirit of, and I'm sure I probably got something wrong about this, but it turns out that's another strike day, or there's something else wrong. I mean, I didn't pay very much attention to Easter weekend problems there were down the road, which were largely to do not with strikes, but I think massive, repairs or whatever. But the net of it is leaving everybody who's going south of the border with this kind of slight terror of planning train journeys, because it looks like they still seem to be subject to so much disruption. And I guess we've just got to a stage where you kind of go, what? There's a big strike again. I mean, OK, there's been disruption here, but over the piece, and particularly with relation to all the health unions, the Welsh was it last week, they've still got their junior doctor strike on, the English have still got a junior doctor strike, and you think to yourself, do you know, you'll end up settling with them, why don't you just settle? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what's the problem? Equally, you know, the sort of threat of walkouts in Scottish schools got across all unions ended last year. And then you got to throw in the council tax freeze, you know, because that went the other way. That was hardly a bit of conciliation. Mm-hmm. But Joe, over the piece, there's been a fair amount of conciliation from Humza. I think the problem with it is, though, that this is not how people rate a first minister. I mean, partly that's because you don't rate the positive stuff. You're always looking for what's missing. And the trouble is there is a heck of a lot missing. And a lot of that is because we have got a parliament, a Scottish parliament, that was designed not to have the powers to tackle the economic problems that Scots really care about. Yes. So, this is really almost impossible to get around now. We've got a fiercely constrained devolved parliament. And people are beginning to want to have real proper solutions to things. But what they're getting from the Scottish Parliament under Humza Yousaf, and I suspect it would have been the same under Kate Forbes or anybody else, is basically Scotland is in a British economic rut. Holyrood only tends to mitigate the cruelest benefit, so-called reforms. It can rename things like free ports into green free ports, whoop, whoop. And it can legislate for behavioural change more soon on that, doubtless, you know, which is where I think a lot of the anger over the hate crime bill comes from. Because it's taken, I've realised it's sat on the stanks for kind of a wee while, but it looks like it's taken two, maybe more years of parliamentary time to come up with something that doesn't feel more important to people than the economy, land, our industrial base being captured by overseas companies, the kind of a very good article by Jonathan Chaffee in today's National, which is talking about the kind of takeover of a lot of Scottish government by consultancies and kind of, you know, vested interests who are deciding how our assets should be presented for sale, and that's not ScotWind, and then ending up kind of part of consortiums that are going ahead and buying them, you know. So I think Scots sort of states that we want a kind of proper thoroughgoing change. When I do these Q&As, people will often ask, you know, what would be the first thing to really get going, and I just say every time we need to basically socialize heating in Scotland and just join the rest of the bloody world, especially the northern world, that doesn't leave individual households to sink or swim on their own with individual heating problems and individual boilers, because that's partly what's killing the planet. Every time you need to change so many individual bits of kit. If you connect most people up to district heating, you can change as easily as they're changing all the time on the continent. When new technology comes on board, you just slot in the new technology and it keeps distributing heat and hot water the same way as it's previously done. So, you know, that kind of discussion seems to go nowhere here, because we end up, are we discussing that? Are we discussing, well, we'll end up going on to talk about land reform, for example. I mean, are we discussing these big things, or are we ending up talking about whether or not, you know, a new piece of legislation is actually going to exacerbate hate towards sort of peak protected characteristics, or basically slap people out of the heat and make people just shut up if they're kind of having negative thoughts. I don't, you know, this is, we'll discuss whether that's a good bill, but I think a lot of the energy and annoyance with it is that this is not what people want to see the Scottish government spending its time on. And in the piece, I was just mentioning that, in fact, it was Anna Sarwar
yes.
had the cheek to talk about this. Yep. Actually, in a recent speech where he said, Holyrood has overseen sweeping social change, but we've been very much a social policy parliament rather than an economic policy parliament that has let down Scottish employers and Scottish workers. I mean, if you have a piece of carpet, just go and bite it now. You do wonder which party stood in the way of devolving real economic powers back in the day. But still, it may not be fair. And there's no point in sour grapes. This has been a social policy parliament. And people expect, Scots of all, you know, of all the nations of the UK, understand economic policy. I always remember that from when I started off as a Brownie reporter down in Westminster in the parliamentary unit in the 1990s. And, you know, there would always come late in the day if you were doing a late shift and you were monitoring Parliament. Every other part of the UK would sort of just perk up if they heard that one of their MPs had made a speech and would just ask for 30 seconds of it. The Scots would phone up at about sort of 8 o'clock at night and say they would quite like a 4-minute package about the renationalisation of gas. I mean, the Scots were like, it was, I have to say, I found this to be a huge badge of pride, but they were like the only serious kittens in the kind of, you know, menagerie. Yeah. The Scots were always wanting to understand economic systems, and we're still there with it, but we haven't got a parliament that can do very much about it, or we haven't got a government that's prepared to use the control it's got to be able to start moving in the direction that we want. And I think a lot of that projection, the frustration now of having got to the stage where we've had social policy up to our oxters, we're now wanting to see some big, inclusive, bold piece of something outside our heads change, you know, in reality. And we're not seeing it.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm going to ask it, which will be a rhetorical question, Leslie. I do realise it, but throw it out there. But why this lack of boldness in areas over which the Scottish government has control? Why the lack of boldness there? Is there a tendency to actually, a stakeholder concept? Too many people, as Jonathan Chaffee has said, who are embedded in the system, who are vested in not changing the system that much. You know, and or is it easier to tackle social issues where there can be a consensus across the parliament? Because, I mean, I note I don't quote Stephen Daisley very much, but he said that if anyone points the finger at the SNP for the Hate Crime Act, it was a consensus decision taken by a significant majority in the Scottish Parliament of SNP, Labour, Lib Dems, Greens, I think one Tory MSP, there was only one political, I think, before abstentions. So it's a consensus. So is there a tendency to move towards the centre in terms of consensus? And is that a factor in terms of the expression, as it wasn't down to Humza Yousaf, who wasn't the First Minister at the time, but is that the kind of function that he feels most comfortable with? And the other question is, you may be a party political leader who is good at conciliation, but is that the kind of person that you want to lead a party into the rough and tumble of elections?
Yeah, well, I mean, you do ask the two big questions in a rhetorical way, right on the back of one another. But I mean, on the first one, why the lack of appetite? I mean, again, an excellent article by Andrew Tuckell, always worth reading, in the Sunday National. And he was actually looking at news. And I honestly, this is predates April the 1st, that Holyrood plans to outlaw pet abduction. Now, my speaker's three cats. If anybody can catch any of my cats, actually, you're doing blooming well. Yeah. They've had about two goes in the vets in their entire lives, actually, because they're wild wee animals. But anyway, he says, increasingly, the limits of devolution seem to be channeling proposals like this through Parliament. not because they reflect real priorities and economic injustices, but because they happen to fall within legislative competence. And I wonder, this is not to get at lawyers, because I know amongst our listeners there are some pretty prominent lawyers, but you know, the legal aspects of things are one, it's one sort of part of a political game. I mean, I noticed there's been a lot of stushy about Bernard Ponsonby's farewell to arms kind of interview on STV, when he was asked who was the, you know, the most impressive politician in Scotland. He mentioned Alex Salmond. And I would say that's absolutely true. And by the way, I don't mean think that means, yeah, let's have Alex back and do everything now. It, you know, this is kind of as a moment in time. He was some blooming operator, and he managed to kind of balance a kind of fairly good understanding of people needing to see progress in a slightly kind of, you know, roustabouty kind of, you know, I mean, a lot of people didn't like him because they felt he was just trying to land, put the heat into blooming everything that came out of London, which, to be fair, would, you know, wouldn't bother me too much, but did sort of see, let's say, needlessly argumentative. But on the other hand, you know, the decision to kind of, I think it was a week two, to send some guys with a ladder up and just change the name of the Scottish executive to the Scottish, you know, Parliament, or the Scottish government rather, overnight. Yeah. And then not just small things, but just put through big things, you know, those things, that was kind of pretty impressive. It was very political, to come to your point. So that, I mean, just because things happen to fall within legislative competence, you know, you can find yourself in your own house. And, you know, over the last couple of days of recovery from trying to stop the random bombing of five airfields in my brain, I've noticed, you know, this kind of compulsion to start tidying small insignificant aspects of things instead of dealing with, you know, obvious signs of kind of, you know, water ingress and big problems, because they look too big to deal with. But yeah, if I get all the condiments lined up in a row, that does feel very satisfying. It really does. Now, I'm not suggesting that MSPs are just lining up salt, pepper and smoked paprika. But there are just bigger things, you know, and of course, it's also true that the lawyers will say this needs to be tidied up and codified and put into form. The thing is, for us out here who don't spend a lot of, you know, we're not spending our whole time in Holyrood, all we seem to see coming out are a series of what look like pernickety definitional changes. And Alex's skill was to keep chucking it around so that you saw other big things coming out as well that affected you in your daily life and seemed to be moving the game on in a kind of economic way. So I think this has been the problem. Just things happening to fall within legislative competence, nah, not good enough. It's not good enough for any parliament, pretty much, but for a parliament run by people who want to, you know, stretch the machine, and who, coming in the wake of a man who absolutely broke all the boundaries that he could possibly break as First Minister. I don't think Nicola Sturgeon did it as much, but Leck definitely went in and just went, you know, limits, I don't really see them. I mean, let's just try. And actually, to give Nicola her due, mind you, she did actually put through the minimum alcohol pricing, which everybody said was impossible and would be challenged everywhere. And it was challenged everywhere. And the Scottish government's position won everywhere. So I think it's the lack of smedum, you know, that kind of, OK, there's the boundaries. The lawyers might get twitchy. You know, who are you? Who else is in your head at this point? And the trouble is, to come back to the points that Commonweal particularly have constantly made, lobbyists. And maybe the point is, another thing I've been thinking about is that, you know, those of us on the left imagine that kind of airing a different outlook through a piece in the National or, you know, podcast or going on and on and on about it in books or films or something like that actually reaches into parliamentary process. I think it doesn't. Not a tiny bit of it. And actually, you know, some folk that I've spoken to within Parliament said, you know, why aren't you guys lobbying? And you sort of think, what? I mean, on top of having to do everything else you're going to do, we've got to come in and freaking spoon feed this in. Oh, open your mouth. Look, it's a little helicopter coming in with the thing, you know. And you think, what is this? I can remember myself when we did Nordic Horizons. We were all volunteers on that. It took about 2 months of my year as a volunteer to do all the arrangements for getting people over from the Nordic countries, 72 of them in total over 12 years or so. They stayed in my flat in Edinburgh when I had one, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And in the end, we discovered that the civil servants were very keen to hear what they had to say. And I can remember saying to them, well, here's the thing. Come to the meeting in the Scottish Parliament, like all the other humans.
Yeah.
And the thing was, they didn't. And they felt that they couldn't. You know, that they were special, in a special position of wanting to hear someone, and actually even asking questions would have been too public for them in a public forum. It would have suggested where they were coming from, what they, you know, whatever. So in the end, much as it just increased my blooming workload and the poor speaker, who ended up essentially having to do the thing twice at least, we had to have a separate meeting for the civil servants. And to be fair to them, they organised into a wee group to kind of receive that speaker. And by gum, they fairly turned up. Did they do anything about it at the other end of it? Not that I can see.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Do we have to do that? Does the left have to get into a position that we get organised lobbying groups here so that we go in and don't just sort of think, I'm just such an opponent of spoon feeding. I don't like it done to me. I don't imagine it has to be done to other people. But on the other hand, these guys seem to be either so busy or so really overcome by the lawyers and the kind of, you know, KPMG consultants, that if you don't get in with an equal and opposite thinking, then you're stuffed. I mean, I think Believe in Scotland are regularly pushing their, you know, wellbeing agenda in. But that's one, maybe Commonweal are trying, but I don't know, you know, so it certainly gives you food for thought.
Yes, I don't know if either of us actually answered either of those rhetorical questions. That was easy for me to say.
Yeah, well, I tried, so go on yourself then.
It's a grave difficulty because I think that you've got a duality there in the sense of governance. In the sense of governance, I think Humza Yousaf has dealt with the major issues. And that's the paradox. The paradox of devolution is that we do not see up here the devastation that's being caused to the National Health Service. We do not see the devastation of the strikes. We do not see the problems that then arise when you look at... I was listening to a piece on Radio 4 and read the article in The Guardian, which talked about somebody having... I think it was about £250,000 worth of debt, the highest debt in the student debt in the UK. And I'm going, it's not in the UK. It's the highest debt in England. We do not see these things. And that's the paradox of devolution, the paradox of power, I think. That it has undermined the case for independence, because the more competent you become, you're having to have that balancing act of the mitigations and protections which we want to see done to protect from the depredations that have been enacted by the coalition government and then the Conservative government afterwards. We've seen what's happened there. And we want people to be protected from it, but it is putting sticking plasters on it. So that's the only thing I can see. And I genuinely would like to see, and you said, you know, let Humza roar. I mean, I think he's got it in him. I just want him to be rougher and harder and a more rambunctious political leader when it comes to the general election. I think he's got people around him who can do that job and will do it well. But when the focus is on a leader like that, it's down to him. And I hope he does it.
Well, there could be an issue coming, actually. There was one piece that I noticed I sort of set coming to myself a little bit on Sunday. I was reading The Times and I was just I'm completely gobsmacked. I know this. I knew it was coming. We all know it's coming. Thames Water is kind of basically going completely belly up. There was a latest report, but you can just watch the crisis gathering steam for the last several months, that shareholders are now kind of giving up on trying to put more money into Thames Water, because it looks like the deal it tried to pull with the weak regulators of Britain, there's particularly England, Ofwat, It tried to suggest that it needed a 40% increase in prices, Thames Water, and that was going to enable shareholders, Canadians. There's no British shareholders in this after all that fuss. Anyway, that would enable them to put another 500 million quid in to kind of just pour, money down the sink, basically. But anyway, so that was going to be how they were going to lurch on for another year or something. Anyway, Ofwat rejected that. No 40% price rise. So now the latest report from the Times is that shareholders are just basically saying they're not coming up with the 500 million needed. That means Thames Water is almost bankrupt. And one possible answer is renationalisation.
Yeah.
Now, just let that roll round your head, Scots, because I wish I could do the math quickly enough. 1997? Anyway, it's kind of, 25 years anyway since we basically, Strathclyde Region, God love them, we've talked about this before, Charles Gray, the head of Strathclyde, put through the referendum that got the massive 90% sort of, we want our water kept in public ownership, that stymied Thatcher, that kept three companies in Scotland in public ownership, which amalgamated, formed Scottish Water. And yes, there are problems with it. And I think there's also a part that was privatised of the sewage system. I'm going to have to find this out sometime because it keeps getting slightly raised and I'm never sure. But the bulk of Scottish Water is in public ownership. Right. And now, after that decision that we took and the money we've put into our public supply, we're going to end up having to pay for the renationalisation of Thames Water.
Yep.
And it'll be astronomical, even though people are saying just wait till the asset price completely collapses, which shouldn't be very long, and you can pick it up for a song. Ooh, what do you think the other, I think it's 18, there's 19 of them, private water companies, they're all in a terrible state. So, is that what we're going to do? I noticed there was a piece by Alison Pearson. That is a real Freudian slip. Libby Purvis, who says it was actually a very interesting article. The headline says, "Our privatised utilities are a busted flush." Oh, my God. No, yeah. No. And she says, "Experiment with public services that began in 79 has not taken account of investor greed." Oh, God, really? God. Scots looked at the proposition by Thatcher, voted against her in huge numbers, saw that, private greed was no way to be basically running public services. And blow me, the rest of kind of Britain is slowly beginning to kind of catch up with this. But we're going to end up having to pay for that mistake, as well as it having happened and us avoiding it. This is crazy. I suppose you could argue that, it's general UK money that went into helping Scottish Water stay in the public domain. But, we've got to a stage now where that you've got to have independence now to be able to weed out public services, run them differently, keep them differently, whack them out of the head differently, and make things work in this country. Because having spoken earlier about Alex Salmond and his kind of ability to try and push the boundaries as far as possible, it was only as far as possible. And at any moment, the UK can just throw up your tiny little defences against crap, basically. And in the case of water, that's quite literally true. There was the Oxford-Cambridge boat race and the winners, Cambridge, couldn't even go in, jump into the river because of E. coli in the river. I'll be interested to see what, not that I'll be canvassing opinion too widely in a very short trip to London, but, I haven't been down the road enough to see what people feel about this. But, are we sort of psychic that we could see that this would inevitably happen, but it took everybody else going through this experiment with private greed on the world's most precious resource before you finally come up short and think, my God, look, we're stuffed. Because you are stuffed. It'll take, if you read into the analyses by scientists, it will take decades to sort out English water. So I can't remember quite why that rant began. So maybe
No. It was what we had control over. But again, it's that compare and contrast. And when you were talking about...
Exactly so.
Yeah.
But actually, it was more the thing of, So here's the thing. I mean, it probably isn't a very easy thing to make a big issue out of, but I'll be blooming making as big an issue as I can out of it. If Thames Water goes bust and Scottish taxpayers end up contributing to the zillions needed, not just to buy this over, because that will be the small thing. The big thing will be public money having to be poured into that company to try and fix a situation where basically rivers in, you know, around the south of England look like, first of all, they're full of sewage, and second of all, are going to run out of, you can hardly believe that with this rain, but are going to run out of water again this summer and are due to run dry in 30 years. I mean, I'm, you know, not trying to be horrible about it, but I mean, like, the kind of outlook that of neediness that's going to occur when the south of England finally wakes up to the crisis that it's in with its water management, is that something Scotland wants to be part of? Because not only will we end up paying for it, but it will end up, because Britain does this, being a one-size-fits-all solution when we actually have very different kind of situation with our water management here. So, God, if it's not energy, then it is water that is the one that should really whack people out of the head. And when we come politically to that, I would almost feel strongly about this, that I would refuse to pay. And I know that you can't get that because it will not be a special Thames Water tax or anything. But I wonder if there's a way to try and highlight that as an issue, because I'm sure a lot of Scots who are pretty so-so and don't think things are coming to a head, my God, this is the first of many.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, everybody is aware of the fact of the plans to transport our energy, you know, our renewable energy source. And, there you go. But that's pulling and sharing for you, Leslie. And the other thing that occurs to me is the constant. It's always capitalism for the poor and socialism for the rich. You know, we'll suck all the profit out of it the minute we get into bother. Oh, we need state money. We need state money. Buy us out. So, but yes, we are currently constrained by the devolution settlement. And the two areas that we're going to go on to talk about are, again, the areas which come fall directly within devolved powers, and the Hate Crime Act, which has taken another turn because it did come into force on April 1st. And yes, we do know it's been picked up by everyone else. Did nobody, as I said before, did nobody think this wasn't a smart day on which to introduce it for all sorts of reasons and the pettiness that could take place within that framework? And when I listened to Radio 4, and I think it was Evan Davis who was interviewing Community Safety Minister Siobhan Brown, who sounded a bit nervy to me and a bit nervous. I mean, she wasn't, didn't have a solidity within that framework of what she was being asked to a certain extent. But what it did is they kept focusing on this. And what didn't come out of the interview was this fact of the consensus across the Scottish Parliament didn't come out clearly, because she once said it was unanimous, which it wasn't. And then it ended with this whole statement from Evan Day saying, and what would happen if someone in England, you know, went out with the law in terms of what was framed in Scotland. And there's a stunned silence. Says, well, that's in England. It's nothing to do with us. And then I looked at it and I went and did a bit of research on it, because I saw some pieces on it. And even though it's framed in a different way in England, because they've got, it's across, it's not a single comprehensive hate crime law. It's across a whole range of legislation. The legislation in England is fundamentally exactly the same as the legislation will be in Scotland now, in terms of the protected characteristics and the way it's reported, the Crown Office Procurator, the CPS down there and up here. It's very, very similar. And yet we have Rishi Sunak leaping in to the J.K. Rowling statement about she is daring Police Scotland to charge her with hate offences. And it's just a lot of heat there, which I think could be, as I spoke about last week, could be taken out of it. If, number one, I believe, and this is my little piece, misogyny should have been included in the Act from day one. And if not because it was important, Misogyny Act should have been running in parallel at the same time. So on April the 1st, the Misogyny Act should have come into force at exactly the same time. And the other aspect, Sunak has the gall to actually turn around and talk about the impact on freedom of speech, where he has a government which is fully inclined to remove the European Convention on Human Rights. And yet that is enshrined in the freedom of speech, I think it's section 10, within the Act, that freedom of speech is enshrined there. So we wait for the vexatious complaints, but there's also the vexatious elements from people like Elon Musk coming along on the sidelines and Rishi Sunak chipping in. As an anti-SNP, where it was a consensus decision across the Scottish Parliament.
Yeah, well, yes, I mean, absolutely. I'm just noticing Joanna Cherry, though, has actually tweeted saying, for those under the misapprehension, the Hate Crime, etc. Act in Scotland brings a line into law with England and Wales. Mm-hmm. Here's an excellent thread setting out significant differences. And then you really need to sit and get your head into a legal frame to sort of be able to figure out how important the legal differences are. Although that question of misogyny being so important, it was left to a whole new act, which then inconveniently looks like it's going to take years to kind of come out the other end. That has also been highlighted. I see that Peter Tatchell was interviewed on Radio 4 and he was talking very much about deploring the fact women are not protected from hate under the Act. So that just as it looks, and again, you know, but it's very possible, and I'm not even going to characterise it, but to say, let's say some professional has said all boxes have been well ticked and this is, you know, a properly legislated for thing. Yeah, the way it looks on the outside is also building on what has already happened. You know, call us creatures of habit, but that's actually how we understand our world. We notice patterns and stuff that's happened. So again, we've had long conversations about gender reform, recognition reform, and people will feel again that there's a kind of change in the dial for women in that. And mm-hmm. that, you know, here we are with the same back-footedness, it would seem, for women. Now, I mean, I was thinking about this in a sort of, you know, more general sense, because, you know, we're back in this thing. Otherwise, this idea of hatefulness, for example, even that word, you know, hateful, this sounds so sort of Bunter and Enid Blytonish, you know, the hateful kind of look of somebody. And it doesn't sort of feel like it's a thing that you kind of either see or feel. I mean, either somebody is a complete BAM, I'm not suggesting you have a BAM act, you know, but it's more that the phrasing around this and then that campaign that the Scottish government seems to have come up with the hate monster.
Oh, don't get me started.
Did nobody just look at that and think this is really childish looking?
Yeah.
You know, so that it keeps compounding the problems of stuff. I can't remember the long list. You will. The football thing that had to get tanked.
Yeah.
About the football supporters thing, what was that?
Yeah,
again?
That was the offensive behaviour, act. Yeah, and we'll come on to that again.
There was another one that one also, but it keeps seeming to be this question of we're going to try to improve people's behaviour to one another by putting in legislation that essentially tries to prevent bad behaviour, but then comes down to defining stuff in ways that people find just really difficult, you know, or not on, or not the way it turns it is, or that kind of stating something really strongly on behalf of one group appears to then diminish the rights of another one.
Yeah.
And there's a naivety about thinking that's not the case and that it doesn't matter. So especially when you've been warned. I've had three bits of legislation that have all been problematic. You could throw in the named persons.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have an argument about that. I still have friends who work in schools that think the named person, there was nothing wrong with it. So it's kind of like things are getting now captured by a feeling that there is a disproportionate desire to try to kind of, you know, describe away the way that you ought to behave, and for the state to kind of be moving into areas that really belong to individuals, parents, whatever else. Now, if that's a vibe that's on the go, and that's not just the Daily Express whipping that one up, you've got to be tiptoeing into that area and have good reason to need to walk into it again. And as I said before, you know, there's plenty of other stuff people probably feel they would like to have seen progress on. So, however, here's the other thing then. I mean, what I noticed on whatever day it was, I surfaced and had a look at stuff. You know, there's clearly been utter mischief making in that there was a whole lot of people saying that they had reported the speech made by Humza Yousaf
a few years ago
when he listed all the white leaders of, you know, everything, basically, and that this would be an example of hate crime. I mean, it's not in that it doesn't stir up. Well, does it stir up racial hatred to make a statement of truth about the facts that, you know, every board that he mentioned was actually run by white people? I don't think it does. It might stir up. It stirs up a lot of kind of awareness, really. And awareness in itself then is something that you can push back against because you don't want to hear it. So this is all difficult, but if this results in, this will end up being people at it, basically, the ones who predicted that the police would go under with the number of kind of, you know, essentially mischievous or pointless complaints that are being made may well be the ones who are making the lion's share of them. Because, you know, these points on Twitter were being shared by folk, mostly anti-SNP and anti-independence accounts, who were also giving you the link to how to sort of basically make a complaint about the white speech, if you want to call it that, by Humza. So it's kind of like serves him right. There's the irony. Well, you see, you know, it's very kind of triumphalist. Sure, the police in the middle of it are just kind of doubtless going under with having to kind of deal with each one because these are meant to be priorities. This was the problem we did discuss, and I can't see a way around that because having known somebody who was in the police for a long time, when these directives occur, you just have to dump so much other stuff.
Yes.
So, you know, this doesn't seem very well thought through to me. And yet when you come right back to the other hand, I don't know what made me think about this way, way back, Section 28, Section 2A in Scotland. I don't know if anybody remembers the blooming stushy there was about that when, again, Thatcher's government prohibited the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities. It came into effect in 1988, that long ago, folks, you know. And there was a huge stramash about that. It was eventually when the Scottish Parliament was set up, the Parliament passed legislation that essentially just repealed it. But that, it was repealed in 2000 in Scotland, before England, 3 years before England. But I remember that Wendy and Alexander in particular took a lot of pelters over it. And yet, just look at it now. There was obviously that big case, you know, the big efforts made by... sorry, my brains have just stopped now.
Brian Suter?
That's it. I mean, my brain goes bus driver brother.
Yeah.
Brian Suter. Oh God, and I thought I was back to speed. Anyway, you know, after all of that, you know, so that's 1988, and there was a big stramash about trying to get shot of a legislative, well, basically something that prohibited promoting homosexuality. By in schools. And I can remember all of this same stuff, all the hysteria about children being taught to be gay, about, you know, how do teachers who were offended by gay people, how are they going to be, you know, able to be teachers and have freedom to kind of, you know, the right to be able to not, you know, promote this, what was called propaganda. And now look at it, you know, we've had equal marriage. We've got recognition of trans people. I think, you know, we've now, the change that there is in TV drama of just now, this outpouring actual of kind of almost relief, where almost every series has got, quite naturally, has got a gay couple within it.
Yeah.
Just nobody bats an eyelid, even within the storyline now. Mm-hmm. It isn't a sort of tortured, oh my God, will I come out?
Yeah.
So that's still there for folk. But, you know, the way that this is being promoted within the public sphere these days is that this is a pretty normal thing. I turned out taller than my brother, you know, let's say, You know, somebody's turned out gay, someone's turned out straight. So what?
Exactly.
Now, 1988. So that's kind of what, 35 years. Mm-hmm. Back then, we were seriously, in Scotland, we were seriously having the same sort of, you know, really disturbed, frightened, defensive kind of, not so much hysterical, because I don't, you know, I don't know where everybody's coming from. But, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, the next generation will not care about this. They already don't care. They already don't care about, you know, what about trans. They care in the sense of they want their trans friends to be treated well.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm coming across. So in a sense of, I certainly don't want to end up, you know, with any of my stepdaughters being told that they're, you know, when they're pregnant, that they're pregnant people. I don't want women's rights to be absolute removed, or safe spaces to be jeopardized, or women academics who are able to say a woman does not have a penis. I don't want those women to be hounded out of academia.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't want to end up in a situation where trans, the next generation, are somehow told that our preoccupations with things being 100% one way or the other are things they have to deal with.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I really wonder if we're just in another sort of Section 28 lather. And the point being, in 1988, we were in that lather. You know, we it's great to have hindsight, but we were there then.
Yes.
I just wonder, having been through this once, whether there's a certain aspect of us going there again.
Well, the thing I was thinking there, and have thought for a while, what I object to are, I mean, you saw some of the folk outside the Scottish Parliament with very strange, odd and mischievous perspectives, I think, on it, and reactionary perspectives. And what they do is they undermine the serious points that someone like Joanna Cherry makes. They undermine it by their very actions and by the way they behave and by the points that they are making. So, and again, I come back to, and it goes to the highest level, someone like Sunak chipping in there is undermining the significant points that someone like Joanna Cherry makes. And I think you're absolutely 100% correct in the sense that, having gone through this before, people should have been, and this is coming down, being politically savvy. They should have been politically savvy enough, if not sensitive enough, to the issues that were ongoing, to take their time, think this through, engage with far more with gender critical women and bring it on board. And as I say, just be far more careful about it. The thing I'm going to end on, though, is because you've got strange bedfellows, you've got Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, and lo and behold, into the mix comes Ali McCoist, ex-Rangers player and pundit on Sky and on Talk Radio. And he was on Talk Sport, saying, "I can guarantee you next Sunday, I, along with 48,000, will be committing a breach of that hate bill in the particular Rangers v Celtic game we're all going to. It is madness." So there we have it. There is that's the bedfellow. That's that's going along with it, that undermines the serious points that Joanna Cherry's making, where he can turn and say, "Well, we can sing all we like, you know," and McCoy's coming out and saying, "I can say all these hateful things," which I am saying will be stirring up hatred in terms of people's race or their religion, and this bill is going to be tackling it. And will that actually, and I've got one of these difficulties as well, in the sense that legislation does change people's behaviours, and those behaviours then change the mindset. So I do think there's a direct connection between it. And this may seem a minor one. I remember my father ranting about not wearing a seatbelt when he was driving.
Mm-hmm.
Legislation came in, he wore a seatbelt, and within 6 months, my dad, who was vehemently, passionately opposed to this restriction on his freedoms, automatically put a seatbelt on and didn't think about it. So
The thing is, I doubt, I hear that actually, and you know, having also had a dad who was a pilot in the Second World War and used to refer to the gear stick as the joystick, which was somewhat alarming actually sometimes in the way he drove. And I never got a license actually because he learnt to drive during the war, so they didn't need a license. And let's say he was quite frisky on the old kind of freedom to move across the road kind of scenario. So he was also another guy that just didn't like being told what to do at all. And if the law changed, however, very law abiding in that respect, would just sort of hop to it. I think this is about deeper identity, and this is the trouble with especially that Ali McCoy's Celtic Rangers stuff. I guess the only thing that starts to happen is we're having, this thing has got an awful lot of people discussing things. I don't know it from a tremendously useful perspective. Mm-hmm. The thing most people will feel is if you try to tell me what I can and can't do, I will get extremely annoyed.
Yes.
And I'm pretty much there. quite a level-headed person, but I really, really dislike being told what to do and think. Mm-hmm. So there's all of that. Just in case, when you said just the last thing, I hope we're not just ending in the sense that I know we have to talk. We're talking about land reform, and I'm not saying we have to talk about it, but I'm noticing just coming online when we're here. I mean, just this awful, awful thing that's happening in the Middle East now, where 7 aid workers in Gaza have been killed.
Yeah.
And Netanyahu is saying that the deaths of 7 aid workers in Gaza is a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
This makes me so angry, and there's nothing I can do except not pass that by. What this could well be is a horrible catalyst, because, David Cameron is now wanting an explanation. One of the aid workers is apparently British.
Yeah.
I think it looks like there's US, Australian, Polish and Palestinians, although obviously they won't care about them, amongst the dead. But that means all these countries, all these people that have sat on their hands to varying degrees, they've now got one of their nationals caught up in the middle of all of this, trying to deliver aid to starving people. Everybody and their aunt has verified that there is now famine in Gaza. It's extraordinary. We've got all sorts of institutions that are meant to mean something, from the European Commission to the UN Security Council. And I mean, if this cannot now push forward Joe Biden to get to a stage, and the British, who are still supplying arms, we have got to get that stopped. And this might well be the moment that people begin to reorganize and push on this front, because that, although it seems, it actually makes you weep, the idea that 7 people, and it's terrible that they've died, because those were people who voluntarily went in to help other people. But for Netanyahu to call those 7 innocent, when the kind of flattening of Shifa Hospital has just been a success.
Yep.
I mean, how can we sit in this world and listen to this rubbish? And where is our government on it? Where are world bodies? All of this has got to move now. This has got to be the only thing that gets resolved and pushed this week. And I hope that the SNP, I see Stephen Flynn again has been tweeting about this. Everybody support that. But we've got to get some strategizing together for how to push this forward.
Yeah. I mean, and that's again, we talked earlier about Homsay Yousaf. Right from day one, week one, he talked about collective punishment. He talked about what the Israeli Defense Force were doing. He saw what was coming down the line. And unlike Sir Keir Starmer, David Lammy, etc., within the Labour Party, the SNP under Homsay Yousaf and in the Westminster leadership of Stephen Flynn have been absolutely on the money, sadly, about what they saw coming down the line. And they've been on the money about what should be done. And there is an absolute abrogation of moral responsibility with the UK government in kowtowing to Netanyahu and his far right government and those who are within this cabinet, like Benny Gantz, who are theoretically far more moderate No, Israel is a rogue state. It's an apartheid state. It is engaging in collective punishment against the Palestinians. And the claims that they're making, let's reflect on this. Oh, it was Hamas who bombed Al-Shifa Hospital. No. Have we all forgotten that? It was a Hamas rocket that hit it. Look at the devastation in Al-Shifa Hospital. I mean, and we've got to preface this with the Hamas government attorney said there are 400 people dead there. And again, we see these statistics. These are real human beings, men, women and children, patients who've been killed there. They claim that they've killed 200 Hamas terrorists and captured 500 other prisoners. So they claim there were 700 Hamas in Al-Shifa Hospital. And in the immortal words of my granny, Ehe me doots on that. I would not believe one single word that comes out of the Israeli government on this matter entirely.
And the thing is that whilst anybody watching this will feel that now, you know, because we've heard time and again, you know, when they went into that area before and were meant to have, you know, cleansed the whole hospital network of Hamas. Yeah. And then strangely, OK, there they are again. But the important point now is, for example, a Tory, Alicia Cairns, who's the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select mm-hmm. Committee. Right. You're not holding your breath. Right. But she has said that the UK has received legal advice.
Yes.
That would mean that the UK should cease all arms sales to Israel immediately. And that was made public on Saturday. So UK government lawyers say Israel is breaking international law. And that was said by Alicia Cairns. She has not denied it. It was said in a private meeting. It's been leaked. It was recorded and it's been leaked. It's not now being denied by her. So, you know, what we now need to just organise. This is what politicians are for. Lawyers are for. Come on. Let's just get this together. Countries supplying arms to Israel are complicit in criminal warfare. That's what the advice apparently says. Let's get going on this.
Yeah. Full stop. Will they, though? I mean.
Yeah, but, you know, there's nothing more you can do that. That has to be the objective. A campaign needs an objective. There it is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't often descend into silence on matters such as on anything. As people who know me says, you know, why use one word when Kat can use half a dozen? But it is, I'm stunned into utter silence about the complicity of the Western world. And you're absolutely right. It's Joe Biden. They can stop this right now by withdrawing support for Israel in terms of supply of money and supply of arms. They can stop it right now. But Netanyahu has been brass neck and barefaced. And this may seem I saw this, and this was kind of like a gut punch to me when I noticed it, that Netanyahu is going in for, I think it's for surgery, yeah. and will be getting a general anaesthetic, yes. unlike the pregnant women who are undergoing cesarean sections without anaesthetic, unlike the bairns who've had limbs amputated without anaesthetic. And that's who you're supporting. If you do not stand up and make that moral judgment, you, the UK politicians, US politicians, you are utterly complicit in that, and you are carrying out these atrocities as surely as the IDF.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Now, we did talk about the fact that we've got land reform, we've got multiple other things to talk about. But I don't know about you, Leslie. I think land reform is such a significant issue. I think we should actually spend the half an hour or so that it would take to go through this next yeah. week rather than this week, because it is a major issue, and I think in particular is one which highlights the difficulties of the Scottish government. We've talked about earlier in this podcast of not being bold enough and possibly listening to too many vested interests and stakeholders in the creation of what is supposed to be significantly changing the landscape of land ownership within Scotland. So I think we'll leave that to next week. I have no recommendations whatsoever to make on television programmes. Oh, goody.
I remember it. There was a tremendous series, I think it was on BBC4, called The Gone. I think, you know, it could have been the, and then anything else with four letters, you know, it could have been in, that could have been back in the airfield sort of section. Yeah. But but it was, it's an amazing co-production between the Irish and the New Zealanders. Okay. So the plot basically is about about an Irish Maori sort of link up investigate a crime. Now, there's an awful lot of, you know, fairly predictable stuff that can happen when you either get the Irish, my God, we're so cheery, or Maoris, you know, we're so ethnic. And actually, this one, to my mind, just manages to avoid all the cliches. I mean, there's a point where there's a sort of very world-weary Irish detective in it. And the Maori woman, he's basically swearing as usual about something. And she's kind of saying, my God, I can't do her accent. She's kind of saying, God, it's amazing how the Irish can make swearing sound so. And then she just takes a breath and the Irish guy says bitter. And she says, you know, cheery, basically, at the same time. And I thought, yeah, that just about sums it up, really. It's like, so there's lots of, and there's, I hope that the Maori rituals that are shown within it are accurate. I haven't checked it, but I would have suspected, you know, that it looks like, given that it's being anchored by one, you know, co-produced by New Zealand companies, it looks like that's probably true. And also, I mean, being somebody who will never probably get to New Zealand, but keeps hearing about it and just is fascinated by it. It's also got loving, languid, lots of scenery in it. So you actually see New Zealand. So I think it was a tremendous series and it's on the iPlayer. So I would go for that, folks.
Right. I mean, and I know people may not be into golf, but the terrific Netflix series called Full Swing Series 2, which actually penetrates beneath the what was going on with the Live Golf sports washing, but also is a fascinating insight into mental health amongst men. And I recommend it to you on that basis. It's very, very interesting. And Rory McIlroy, funnily enough, comes out of it very, very well. As do a couple of American golfers, or three or four American golfers, that I never would have rated at all in terms of perception, their perspectives and their thoughtfulness. But again, it's very interesting. But when you were talking about the Maoris and the Irish, it goes back to a Celtic media festival where I sat in a tremendous discussion between Maori, Irish speaker, Scots Gaelic speaker and Scots speakers, about the way we all had our culture and our language positively educated out of us, going through the school systems. So, I mean, I love these connections that can take place. And before we go, actually, just to say yet again, thanks. It's coming around to this time of year when we actually set up the subscription service, just to say thanks to everyone who's been subscribing. And I've been checking the emails rigorously, folks, so I'm trying to get back to everybody as quickly as I can who's have difficulty either unsubscribing or subscribing, trying to resolve those situations. And be aware, check your emails, folks, because I note that because it's the way it operates, that, and it happens with me, folks, debit and credit cards go out of date. So if you get an email which is headed Leslie Riddick Podcast Subscription and it comes from P for Paddy, that's me. I'm checking up to see if you want to continue with the subscriptions and thanking you all for your support in the past and for your continuing support in the future. And on that note, we'll see you, and I promise it will be live reform next week, chaps.